and Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Com. So nice to have you with us this evening. I'll be with you for the next 2 hours. And if you didn't hear my name in that introduction, it is still Don Nikoloff. And we are going to have a very interesting show tonight with our regular Friday night guest. He is our resident science advisor and becoming sort of a spiritual advisor along the way. We've been embarking upon some deeper truths, dispelling some of the myths about science and about the universe, about technologies, very advanced technologies, some that have been around for thousands of years and revived through the work of some very unique and not so well-known scientists. And we're going to be discussing some of the more advanced technologies. Friday night seems to be a good time to talk about ufology and the solar system, the galaxy, and the universe. And we're going to be doing some of that tonight, as well as touching upon some little-known connections between certain political factions that have attempted to rule the earth, and it's rather revealing that they've not been able to do this with their own information, but have had to sort of adopt information that comes from some other societies that have been living on the planet a lot longer. And we're going to talk about that and connect some dots and hopefully bring more truth to the picture so that we can better discern what is going on today. The ultimate purpose for that is self-empowerment. Now, on this November the 28th, or the 29th, if you're on the East or Coast and Central time zone, good morning to you and not good evening. We are going to invite onto the show our regular Friday night guest. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and has been on every weekly, at least once a week, ever since this show has been broadcast, not just here on BBS Radio. As you may or may not have heard, yesterday was the first anniversary of the show, specifically according to the date, and so I'm very happy for all the people that have joined in on a nightly basis to share with us. We encourage you to call in if you have some questions or comments about the show. We always ask that you do that, and to make it easy on our engineers, we ask that you call in on Station 2, and they can patch us in together, so to speak, studio term, so that they don't have to do any wire crossing. So if you're going to call in, make a comment, or ask a question, please call in on station number 2. With that, I would like to invite back to Evident Footprints the gentleman I just described, and his name is Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be aboard.
Well, now the big question is, do we have Jim Murray on the line? I'm not hearing Jim Murray.
Can you hear me at all, Don?
We have him on the line, and they haven't patched him into the board. So, also, I got a message here from Don Newsom that we are running on station 1 and 2. So I guess that means you can call in on 1 and 2. And Don, if you're listening to me, please let me know if we have Jim Murray on the line. I'm not hearing anything, so I'm presuming that that connection's being made. Well, I'll begin tonight's show hoping that he's hearing this and he's attempting to get Jim hooked up with us here.
Hey, Don, can you hear me?
Oh, now he can hear you. Okay. Were you here all along, or?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly, but you couldn't hear me when I spoke to you.
Okay. Yeah, I can hear you now. Okay, so it sounds like we might have just had a technical glitch or something. Sometimes it's just pushing the right buttons, Don. So, welcome to the show, Jim.
Yes, thank you. Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
I did. It was also my birthday, so I got, rarely do you get to eat turkey on your birthday, and rarely do you get birthday cake on Thanksgiving. So it was kind of a cool day, you know. Got to spend time with family and a few friends. And of course we did a show last night, so it was interesting, interesting day. Holidays seem to be something, different from what they used to be when we were kids, but I enjoyed it, and I hope the listening audience did too.
Well, congratulations on your birthday.
Thank you. How was your Thanksgiving, by the way?
It was very quiet. I was fortunate enough to have the invitation to attend Thanksgiving dinner with my electronics associate and his family. And it was very good.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. We're going to touch upon some different topics tonight than what we have been in recent weeks. As a reminder to our listening audience, we've been focusing on consciousness. And of course, that doesn't mean that we're not going to discuss consciousness tonight. But we're going to get into the aspects of some technologies that have been around for quite some time and try to dispel myths as to whether or not these technologies actually exist or existed in years gone by, particularly prior to World War II. And then try to just connect some dots here and see if we can't make sense of some things. And I know that you've got some prepared material, let's say, that you want to share with the listening audience. So if we can agree as to where we're going to kick this off, you know, I'm open to any suggestions.
Well, in one of our conversations prior to the show, Don, we had talked about how some of these technologies come into existence and how old they might be. And you and I had both agreed upon the example of the invention of the airplane. So it might be cool to start with that only as a means of stepping off, and then from there we can go back to the Valex and the Vimana and some of the other machines that we talked about, and then we'll just let it free flow from there, because we can cover any number of topics, as you know.
Okay, well then I'll turn the mic over to you, and with the caveat that I feel free to interrupt when necessary, so... Be
well,
my
after
guest.
After all, it is your show, you know. Yes, well, what we had talked about was how invention is related to higher consciousness, and the fact that everything that ever existed since the time of creation has always been here under man's nose, and yet, for the most part, years and years go by without us seeing what's in front of us until some kind of inspiration comes along and aligns our consciousness to take notice of something which already exists in nature. And then all of a sudden, there's a flurry of creative activity in that direction, which results in the formation of a new technology. And one of the examples that we talked about was the fact that the Wright brothers, despite all of the scientific evidence to the contrary in their day, determined that they were going to invent a machine that was heavier than air and could produce artificial flight. Now, those guys had taken their inspiration from birds and from earlier investigations done by people like Leonardo da Vinci and various other people. And, of course, it resulted in the invention of the airplane, which we're all familiar with today. But that type of thinking and the inspiration behind it caused me to have a quantum leap in considering what type of inspiration and what type of model from nature was used in alien worlds and possibly on this one at an earlier period, which resulted in the invention of the UFO craft and related technologies. And I find that to be a very interesting line of thought. Now, in nature, we have examples for just about everything that we ever want to pursue. The question is, are we aware of these examples, and do we realize what considering their nature might lead us to? Now, with regard to craft of the type that we now call UFOs, there's a kind of an interesting history, even in our time, or slightly before our time, that needs to be considered before we even ponder on the technologies that may have arisen on other worlds. As you well know, there was a point in our civilization back about 100-something years ago when lighter-than-air type craft were considered the direction in which man was headed. And we started off with hot air balloons, and then we went to helium-filled balloons. And then Count von Zeppelin came up with the idea of putting balloons inside a rigid body in the form of a dirigible or a zeppelin, and motorizing the whole thing so that it would slide through the air, much like a submarine slides through the water. And that, of course, led to the age of the airship, which culminated, unfortunately, in the late 1930s with the destruction of the Hindenburg at Lakehurst Naval Air Station in New Jersey. But there's some interesting things that happen behind the scenes concerning the evolution of the airship. And those are kind of worth considering in respect to what we're endeavoring to explore here. You may or may not realize that the lift that is accomplished by a lighter-than-air vehicle is directly proportionate to the amount of air that it displaces. And in that regard, it's exactly the same law of buoyancy which is put to work in the design of an ocean-going ship. The amount of cargo that a ship can carry in tonnage, including its own inner workings, is rigorously equal to the amount of water displaced by the hull design and the weight of that water. And it's a very similar type of mathematical relationship that governs how much lift you can get out of an airship. When you use a gas lighter than air to displace so many tons of air, then of course you wind up with a lift in the atmosphere as opposed to the ocean. Well, the pioneering work that was done, which led to the development of such vessels as the Graf Zeppelin and the Hindenburg and some of the other well-known airships that emerged from Germany, there were scientists in Germany that were considering how they could increase the displacement of air and thereby increase the lift upon the gondola, but not necessarily doing it with a rigid structure that was filled with ballonets or gas cells that were filled with a lifting gas like helium or hydrogen. And the basic concept involved in this was to produce a bubble which essentially contained a vacuum and which could be expanded to any size but still remain attached to the central portion of the vessel, which was originally described as the gondola. And what's interesting is that if you think about this from the standpoint of the shape involved, it's really quite interesting because you wind up with a gondola, which is then hanging beneath a huge, either spherical or spheroid or disc-shaped structure, which is not necessarily physical in the sense that it's built from any material, but which is essentially a void or a vacuum that is sustained by invisible forces. Now, that would be like saying we have a balloon that operates simply by extending a force field which pushes the air back, but it doesn't have a membrane per se, and therefore the amount of lift it's capable of exerting is directly proportional to how big you can expand this vacuum and displace the air, but you're doing it with forces that have a direct effect on the air molecules rather than with a pressurized gas which is inherently lighter than air. And these ideas were kicked around in Friedrichshafen, Germany, and other places where these designs were being worked on. And I personally don't have knowledge of exactly how these efforts materialized into something, but it's very interesting that towards the end of World War II, some of our pilots in Europe were buzzed by machines that flew at an ungodly amount of speed and which were very hard to see or even fire upon because they moved with such swiftness and agility. And it's very interesting to consider that somehow the leap was made from these early theoretical models into something that turned out to be concrete. And even though we don't know what happened to these so-called Foo Fighters, there's a very good possibility that this technology was either eventually captured or at least encountered by enough U.S. authorities that it went down as being a fact of the war rather than just a legend. And Don, you brought up a very interesting point, which I was not aware of, in our private conversation earlier today regarding an exchange that took place in Antarctica between U.S. troops and Nazis who were apparently using these types of machines. Would you like to comment on that, and then we can return to the main subject and see if we can explore it a little bit more deeply?
Yeah, well, we're, just for the listening audience's sake, we'll be taking this information and sort of jumping into the future a bit, and then we're going to backtrack and lay the foundation so you can be picturing this in your mind while we're describing this. Sometime during and at the conclusion of World War II, the Nazis began moving their operations to what became Neuschwabenland in the Antarctica. And for some mysterious reason, Admiral Byrd, who was not an admiral, was able to put a contingency of soldiers, and I believe there was one aircraft carrier, one battleship, and the rest was support, including 100,000 soldiers who went on an expedition to Antarctica. And under the guise, I might add, of discovering either an opening to the inner Earth or some tunnels that existed there, ice caves and the like. And so the cover story was that it was a scientific expedition. Seldom does one take 100,000 soldiers, an aircraft carrier, and a battleship on a scientific expedition. So the cover story obviously was just that, a cover story, and it was more likely that Byrd's knowledge of the poles, at least on a scientific level, and this information that the Americans had at the time, that there was something quite sinister possibly going on, that the Nazis had reestablished a hiding place of sorts. So they embarked upon this mission, which was initially announced to be at least 6 months long. And within 6 weeks, they were hightailing it back to the United States. They had engaged in a battle with flying saucers being flown by the Nazis. And the craft primarily were known as Vril craft. There were various models of these ships, but they were what we know as flying saucers. In fact, on my website, directlightproductions.com, on the photos page, I do have pictures of some of those crafts. And I have had folks remark that that looks like something they saw in a movie set. It looks like very much like a movie set because it's very realistic. You see German cars, what appears to be an officer's car, much like you see in the movies, and an officer standing there, and a huge, huge craft with all types of scaffolding and support vehicles in the vicinity. You can see gun turrets. You can see a sort of bridge or officer's deck on the ship. In fact, many of the photographs which have been published, author Peter Moon published some photos that he got from a German researcher who was embarking upon a book, and for some reason that book ended up being silenced, so to speak, and pulled out of publication. And so the photographer and the author, or let's say the researcher and the author of that book that was in progress, allowed Peter Moon in his book The Black Sun to publish these photos. It's a particular book that Peter Moon wrote which describes a connection between Montauk, the Nazis, and the Tibetan monks. Both the Americans and the Nazis had consulted at one time or another with the Tibetan monks to discover some of the secrets of the inner earth on the basis of knowledge that had been published but kept from the mainstream. that there were these inner earth tunnels, quite possibly another civilization living inside the earth. And of course, in more recent times, we've discovered through many accounts, reptilians, draconians, and greys living inside the earth. And nowadays, in more modern times, working in conjunction with the black ops divisions of the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex, supported through contractors such as General Electric, the Rand Corporation, on and on. Even though they have a tunnel-boring machine owned, or let's say with the insignia of the U.S. Air Force, why the Air Force would have their logo on a tunnel-boring machine is beyond me. And then to have the Naval Department or the Department of the Navy actually supervising all of this activity. It's how they obfuscate and how they administrate control over these types of programs. So we can assume that they had knowledge that the Nazis had flying saucers and they were going there to discover what was actually going on in Antarctica. And was it something that they could stop? Well, it became quite obvious that they suffered great losses in battles that ensued. And this is a war that was never described, that occurred after World War II. The Nazis were described as having stolen large amounts of gold and even secreting Adolf Hitler, who did not commit suicide in 1945 on May 2nd, and was secreted on a submarine to that area that we're speaking about. He was seen shortly afterward in Argentina as early as 1946. It's alleged that he spent a number of years there, and I've talked on other shows, and we may mention this, that he spent the remainder of his days in the United States, dying in 2004. This is difficult for people to comprehend, but even the topics that we're discussing on tonight's show will stretch one's imagination beyond belief. But hopefully you'll do some research yourself and see that there are photographs of these craft. There are drawings and photographs. Photographs posted on my website, again, directlightproductions.com. You can click on photos, and you can see some examples of these crafts. So in the nutshell, that's the essence of what occurred there. Now, whether they actually found these underground tunnels or not is unknown. They only spent 6 weeks there, and it seems like they were chased out of the area by the Nazi forces that were there and had flying saucers. So I'll turn it back to you, Jim.
Right. And these are just some of the highlights of an ongoing reality which is kept from the public, but which surfaces from time to time in stories that manage to get out either as fables, science fiction, anecdotes, or rumors. But the fact of the matter is, it's pretty clear that an alternative technology to a normal flight has been around for quite some time. And one of the things we wanted to bring this out for was to give us a stepping off point for exploring how higher consciousness is related to technology. And not only this type of technology, but many different types of technology. So the next step in this discussion would be to examine where this anti-gravity UFO-type propulsion system could have had its origins. Now, there are three possibilities that I'm aware of, and maybe Don is aware of something additional, which I'm sure he'd throw in. But the first and most interesting possibility comes from within Germany itself. Not only were the original designers of the Graf Zeppelin and other airships intrigued with the possibility of a balloon that operated without an envelope. But there's also the story of a very humble and very special person who started his career as a forest ranger in Germany's wilderness areas, and wound up making immeasurable contributions to various sciences, not just the area that we're talking about. And of course, his name was Schoberger. Now, Schoberger was intrigued by the fact that in rapidly moving streams, fish could do the strangest things. They could just sit absolutely motionless in the middle of a current, which was strong enough to knock a man over when he was attempting to cross the stream. And the migrating fish, like salmon and other species, which go upriver to spawn, effortlessly glided up waterfalls, almost in an anti-gravity type manner. It wasn't that they were struggling or leaping in the normal sense, because if you stop and think of it, a fish can't really jump. I mean, it's one thing if he leaps out of the water because he's near the surface. It's another thing if he flies up a waterfall that's 10 or 15 feet tall. And yet this is the type of thing that he witnessed, along with other oddities having to do with the way vegetable life arranged itself along the shores of these streams, and other investigations it has regarding the various altitudes to which the tree lines rose on mountainsides, and the study of hydrology and water tables in different areas. And he came to very, very different conclusions about the mechanisms behind these actions that would certainly not be condoned by traditional scientific thinking. And these explorations of his led to a number of early oddities, one including a fantastically designed log flume that propelled logs almost magically down from the heights of the mountains where they were cut down until they reached the wider areas of larger rivers and could be transported in rafts down to the sawmills. And the mechanics and the hydraulics behind these devices were not understood. As a matter of fact, they were actually criticized by people who watched the engineering of these projects. And yet, after they were finished and they performed flawlessly, it became pretty obvious that Schoberger had access to knowledge which most people didn't have. And by his own admission, many years later, he coalesced this information into several machines which were pretty astounding. One of them was a device which generated cold electricity, and I use that word just to distinguish it from normal electricity, which could light an array of light bulbs very easily, simply by virtue of the action of water passing through specially designed spiral piping systems. And then after that, he got involved with this implosion motor, which started off to be a power source based on the implosion characteristics of water that was being forced into a common center, much like the way water goes down a drain. But the interesting thing was that the diamagnetic forces associated with this process seemed to produce other effects related to the way the fish went up the waterfalls. And he eventually claimed to have discovered the secrets of anti-gravity. Now, later in time, there was another source of potential information of this type, which came from Nikola Tesla's mind. And, of course, Tesla had been working with the idea of a new type of airship for many years. I believe his earliest announcements in this regard were in the 1920s, which, of course, links Tesla with Otis Carr, and there's a whole other series of interesting investigations that we've talked about before on previous shows that tie those links together. But toward the end of the war, of course, Tesla was murdered, and his safe was rifled by parties unknown. And exactly what information came from there, we're not sure. But there is one other very interesting avenue that needs to be touched upon. And for anybody that has seen the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie regarding the activities of Indiana Jones, it should be pointed out that even though that particular story may well be totally fictional, the fact of the matter is that the Nazis were sending emissaries all over the world to investigate spiritual, occult, lost science, and all manner of other odd tidbits of information that they thought might be helpful in their quest for world dominance. And as Don pointed out earlier, one of the places they went to was Tibet. And the reason that they went there was pretty interesting because it was common knowledge among certain people that investigated the spiritual activities in Tibet, that some of the lamasteries, which were built in the most precarious places, on huge cliffs, on mountaintops, on the actual sides of precipices and whatnot, had in fact been constructed by making use of an anti-gravity principle, in which a series of monks would form a horseshoe-shaped arrangement involving drums and horns, and they would put these huge construction blocks in the center of this horseshoe, and by making certain notes and certain chords with their musical instruments, these blocks would become weightless and could easily be transported up the cliffs to build these monasteries. Now, of course, that type of force would interest anybody with a military mentality. But it brings us to another interesting question, and that is, where did the monks get that information from? And Tibet, of course, is a very ancient civilization which may have had contact with the Atlantean or Lemurian civilizations in some lost part of time before all of that came to an end. And even though they didn't maintain a true technology per se, they may have latched onto and preserved some basic principles from which later technologies had emerged. So this is an interesting possibility. And it was even alluded to by Edgar Cayce, who said that sometime in the 20th century, Atlantis would be rising. Now, I think a lot of people took that to mean that the lost continent would make its appearance again, and that, in fact, may even be true. But I think that the more obvious explanation is that the various technologies, occult practices and understandings of nature that were embraced by those lost people would somehow make resurgence into our modern world. Don, I'd like to get your comments on that before I take it any further. Do you think that those three possibilities, explaining the Nazis' ability to build these devices, make sense, or have I left something out?
Well, the simplest answer would be yes, first of all. I wonder if I could expound upon the actual method through which the Nazis obtained, I think, a majority of this information, at least from the occult and the historical perspective. Could I share some of that?
Sure, if you know about it more than I do, I'd be happy to turn it over to you. Go ahead.
Well, let's do it in a different way than we usually do. We usually start from the beginning and work our way forward. This might be easier for the listening audience to conceptualize. If we, let's say, start somewhere in the neighborhood of 1943, of course, we could come up to date even to 2008 and probably find that Montauk, which is on Long Island, is still, in effect, an underground, both literally and figuratively, mind control and let's say, advanced technology research project that's going on, where there are people who were taken into different elements of time or different dimensions using these advanced technologies, some of whom have come forward with their stories for a number of years and are still associated in indirectly or directly with the project, those being Al Bielek, Preston Nichols, Stuart Swerdlow, for example. Those are three of the more prominent individuals that are speaking out quite a bit about the experimentation that has gone on at Montauk. And it's really a melding of both the technological and the metaphysical aspects of reality. Now, it's not the reality that we are given, but it's a reality that is being created for us covertly through the discoveries made through Montauk. Now, how did Montauk come about? Well, if we look at the first three letters of that word, Montauk, spelled M-O-N-T-A-U-K, the M-O-N has its derivative in history, and it'll take us all the way to Tibet, and I'll explain how that occurred. Now, Montauk ended up being a result of the Office of Strategic Services, what is known as the OSS, which eventually became the CIA, and their endeavors to extract information, as you referred to the Tibetan monasteries, from the Tibetan monks, who have been around for a long time. In fact, it's presumed that the Tibetans are the original human beings on the planet and would have originally lived exclusively in what is known as Mongolia. The first three letters of the word Mongolia are Mon, M-O-N, just like in Montauk. And Mongolia, of course, is known best for Genghis Khan, who was a warrior. Genghis Khan had a son named Tule, spelled T-U-L-E. Now, some pronounce, or it's pronounced Tule, some also pronounce, or spell it T-U-L-A. However, the Germans added the H in between the T and the U and pronounced it Tule, the same way the Mongolians did. And they formed what was called the Tule Society. The Tule Society was interested in metaphysics and its application to physical or material wealth and a war. And those are the two dimensions of the Tule Society which are predominant. They may have done other things, but it was definitely a part of the Nazi plan. And it goes back to the Egyptian concept of war as well, and the Egyptian concept of metaphysics in the magical sense or the alchemical sense. The Egyptians were alchemists. We have accounts of that in the confrontations in Exodus that Moses had with all of the priests that the Egyptian ruler had at his disposal. The accounts of them turning their staffs into snakes and the like. Now, there was a pestilence that eventually fell upon the firstborn in Egypt, and the Pharaoh, of course, lost his son as well. Now, those are accounts in the Bible. We're not determining whether or not they're true, but this is the sort of magic that we're speaking about. Even some of the higher sciences learned from the Syrians. And so now there is an alien influence from outer space that goes back to the times of the pharaohs. And it's recorded in their history. The Egyptians themselves worshipped the reptiles. They had alligators living in the Nile River, various types of snakes and lizards and anything that you could classify as a reptile was worshipped. Now, that leads one to consider the possibility of the reptilian species that had been or has been or still is controlling the earth on some level. So the Germans, who were also at that time known as the Aryans and told that their origination came from the inner earth. They were supposedly an inner earth society before they became Germans on the surface. And the Nazis were pushing this Aryan agenda. So it goes back quite a ways in history, yet all of this has been literally stricken from any of the history books. On a mainstream level. We were not taught these things in school. The other society that the Germans had was known as the Luminous Lodge or the Vril Society, V-R-I-L. The Vril Society was interested in metaphysics, but they were also interested in the higher sciences, ufology and cosmology. And so they were also a secret lodge that worked hand-in-hand with the Thule Society, but at the same time, they each had their own separate agendas. The Vril Society got their information also from the Tibetans through Mon, or Mangkhut, who was at the time one of the more prominent leaders of what we later came to know as Mongolia. It's highly determined and accepted that the Tibetans would have been the original Mongolian society. And through the course of war and history, they ended up living in the Himalayas, but at one time that was a much larger area than it is now. So like any of the other large empires. Alexander the Great had a rather large empire known as Macedonia that stretched all the way to India. And yet it was divided up and eventually became smaller countries, but the history going back several thousand years, actually before Christ. So the Tibetan monks, having been the first society on planet, or the first human beings on planet, would have more history and more knowledge about all these things that had occurred here as long as they had been here. So it only makes sense that anyone wanting to know the origins of the appearance of aliens would consult with the Tibetans. And they were very wise. They were very disciplined spiritually, mentally, and even physically. So both the OSS from the United States, as well as the two societies, the Vril Society and the Thule Society, actually consulted with the Tibetans. At one point, they had Tibetans in the Nazi army. There was a group of 20 of these monks that were consultants to Adolf Hitler during the war. This may be the first time anyone's heard this outside of reading Peter Moon's The Black Sun, which discloses this information. The gentleman that I referred to earlier who has the pictures of these Vril craft, by the way, is Jan van Helsing. And his book was stopped from publication. And it was upon that point when Peter Moon asked him if he could publish the photos, which he agreed. He wanted to get this information out there. Now, in more recent times, Michael Hesseman has become sort of a disinformation agent, if what Peter Moon has written is accurate, and that he has tried to obscure the origins of these craft or whether or not they actually even existed. But there are numerous photographs. Again, I point out, I have some on my website. And this book, of course, The Black Sun, has many of them. Actually, the photos on my site are much clearer than these. When they were printed out, the backgrounds came out very dark. But one can see the silhouette and the progression of these craft as time goes on. So the interest in the metaphysical aspect of what is going on and how one can tap into these hidden technologies or the hidden energies and the hidden mysteries behind how these things work came from the Tibetans. Even though, as you pointed out very correctly, Jim, they were not developing these crafts themselves. Now, in regard to the Foo Fighters that you mentioned, I've heard accounts from some pilots who describe them as orbs, as if they were like orbs that people see today, round balls of light that had speed, and either they had some sort of conscious intelligence that was driving them, steering them, as if they were monitoring devices. But very likely they could have been miniature craft as well. Some of them were round balls and described in different colors as green, red, orange, blue. Not always in the appearance of a flying saucer. But then again, there's tremendous obfuscation of who developed these craft and who had them first. The fact that the Germans had them, the fact that one would stress that the Germans had them first, is intended to steer us away from the fact that this has been written about in the Book of Enoch, and many other parts of the Bible had some reference to flying saucers. Even the Egyptian hieroglyphics demonstrate not just flying saucers, but aliens in many of the drawings that have been found in the digs that have gone on over the past few centuries. So we know that these things existed, they were seen, they were understood. The pilots of these craft had interacted with people. We have accounts over several thousand years that have been described as mythology. It's an easy way. Mythology is the original word for conspiracy theory. So a way to cause us to think that this is just fiction and nothing could be further from the truth. So
I agree with you 100%. As a matter of fact, as far as mentioning of these types of craft, a so-called ancient history of India talks about the war between India and Atlantis, which was fought, among other things, with flying machines called the Vimana and other larger devices, very similar in construction to airships, which was called the Valaks. And it also describes the use of nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And yet these writings are like 10,000 years old, and they have been preserved as epics. They were written in Sanskrit and originally translated back in the 30s. And what's interesting is the people who translated them thought they were losing their marbles because they couldn't conceive of their translations being accurate when they were describing activities and weapon systems that were not known to the rest of the world at that time. And, of course, they subscribed to the linear progression of history, which we all know now is total nonsense. Mm-hmm. But bouncing back momentarily to your expansion on the concept of Tibet's involvement in this, one of the things that really animated me as a younger man was the constant reference of Tibetans to the underworld of Agartha, and the fact that the tunnel systems underneath the Himalayas supposedly led to this inner world, and that some of the monasteries were actually designed to hide the entrances to these tunnels and allow the holy men in these enclosures to have exchange with the people in the inner earth. So there's another possibility as to the origins of these technologies. But I think what we want to do now is to follow your lead and go to the line of thinking that says ultimately this knowledge came from somewhere, and where is that somewhere, or what is the source of the inspiration that led to the invention of these types of craft? Well, that's a really interesting question, because another subject that we had discussed earlier, which in a sense is actually related, although the relationship may not be obvious, is the construct of the pyramid. Now, pyramids appear in every major culture on the planet. We find them in China, we find them in Mexico, and actually there are rumors that there are pyramids in the United States which have not been, which have deliberately not been publicized. We find them in Mexico, we find them in Central America, and there's also evidence that they may exist in some parts of South America. So a lot of the people that have investigated ancient cultures have surmised that the commonality of pyramids appearing all over the world must be traceable to one or more ancestral cultures that were either destroyed or fell apart, but their concepts in architecture and science and mathematics managed to survive. Now, it's not inconceivable that this could be true, but there's a lot of evidence that points to the fact that these things could also have been discovered totally independently, but the information could have come from the same source. And this leads us to the point that you and I were discussing earlier today, where the raising of consciousness to with the request from the universe for information about a particular subject could in fact lead to tapping into the higher consciousness or the God consciousness for a solution to something to benefit mankind, and therefore have a download to that individual who is acting as a medium, and the utilization of the knowledge from the spiritual realm to make a manifestation of some sort on the earth plane. Now, if that mechanism is utilized, there's nothing to say that a holy man in China and another individual of like spirit in Peru couldn't tap into the same higher mind and get concepts which are related. And as a person who has spent most of his life inventing things, I can tell you that if you petition the universe in the right way for the answer to a problem that can increase the benefits to mankind, the chances are you'll be given an answer. And anyone can do this. This is part of the empowerment that we talked about, the higher faculty of man, which is so downplayed and undertrodden by those people that control the world, because they want others to believe that the only source of information, power, guidance, and knowledge can only propagate from governments, which is utter rubbish. Anybody can tap into these types of sources of information and spiritual guidance. So it could well be that in the very beginning, maybe as far back as Atlantis or Lemuria or Agartha, when it was more accessible, that people from those cultures were routinely tapping into this pool of knowledge available to man, and that the downloads from this were responsible for a number of technologies, anti-gravity, pyramids, the design of temples, basic mathematical principles, alchemy, genetics, God only knows what sort of information found its way down to us by this means.
Mm-hmm. Jim, if I could insert something related to the pyramids, and the statement you just made. I'm sure you probably heard of the Shenzi pyramids in China. You referred to the pyramids.
Yes, I certainly have.
Okay, the pyramids in Giza have the number 16,944, and the exact distance from the Great Pyramid at Giza and the largest of the Shenzi pyramids is exactly 16,944 minutes of arc in longitude between the two points, which would suggest that both pyramids were constructed by the same people, likely the Tibetans.
Well, that's absolutely possible. As a matter of fact, if you want to take it a step further, some of the earlier writings regarding pyramids looked upon the structure as being a source of an energy vortex, but not just locally. We have the more recent way of interpreting this stuff for those who have accepted the possibility of higher consciousness and higher science being behind their construction, to limit it to particular areas as an expression of those cultures associated with those regions, such as the Mexicans, the Olmecs, or the Egyptians, or the early Chinese. But there's also evidence to the fact that the entire planet may in fact have had a special energy grid created by strategically placing and constructing these pyramids with the purpose of setting up an energy field to stabilize the planet. Because we already know that the planet went through a terrible era of vast convolutions and destructive tendencies, probably about 10,500 years ago. And it could very well be that the original purpose of these pyramids was to operate in conjunction with one another and set up forces that link the vortexial activities around the planet with the actual tectonic plates in such a way as to stabilize the planet and prevent it from tipping or oscillating in a destructive manner. And you brought up a point that's very interesting, and I see it as being related to this, Don. Mm-hmm. And that is that if you have a sequence of pyramidal shapes that are interlocked or associated with one another in a particular way, that they can in fact produce a much larger energy field. And you had made reference to that with regard to the miniature pyramid structures that appear in photographs taken inside of certain spaceships, and I think you referenced the work of Dr. Flanagan in that regard.
Yes, Patrick Flanagan was developing a pyramid energy plate that looked exactly like what I saw depicted in a photograph of the interior of a craft.
Well, that to me can't be a coincidence. I mean, if a large number of pyramidal shapes will in fact cause an arrangement of energy that is useful in the interior of a craft, then perhaps a large number of pyramids strategically located around the surface of the planet could have a similar effect for purposes that we may not be aware of yet.
Mm-hmm. It would be interesting pinpoint all of these anomalies as far as the pyramids, their exact location. If we were to find that they were all equidistant from each other, then that would totally support your conclusion that there was some sort of counterbalance taking place to correct some negative reaction that had occurred, possibly this war involving the destruction of Atlantis, for example.
Well, I don't know about the placement of them, to be honest with you. I really don't think they're equally placed, but they might have a geometric consequence based on something that may not be so obvious. One thing I do know, and that is that the Great Pyramid of Giza is located at the exact center of mass of all the continents, or at least the continents in that part of the world, and that can't be a coincidence. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you were to cut out the continents in that part of the world and make it into a flat map, theoretically, if you put a puncture mark at the point where the Great Pyramid resides, you could suspend it by a thread at that location, and it should be absolutely flat. It wouldn't be tipping or bobbing in any direction. And if that's true, and I'll be honest with you, I've never done that, but I have heard about it. That's a pretty amazing thing. But it may also just be the tip of the iceberg. I mean, it could very well be possible that there is a link between funneling huge amounts of this vortexian energy into the center of mass of various areas, which sets up a force field or a reaction that geologists are not yet aware of, which could lend stability to the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And we do know that the planet has the tendency, and has done so in the past, of tipping over on its axis. Which makes for a very sudden rearrangement of the entire world as we know it. And maybe there was an effort made at one time to prevent this cycle from reoccurring. I do know that, and you probably know more about this than I do, Don, with your metaphysical background, but I do know that man is given, I think it's one great year in which to achieve spiritual awareness to the point where the harvest of humanity is ready for separation into a higher domain of existence. And one great year is approximately 26,000 years, and it corresponds with the precessional oscillation of the planet. And the fact that it has this precessional oscillation is a suggestion of the fact that there's momentum surviving from an earlier cataclysmic age.
Mm-hmm.
And the possibility, in my imagination, exists that there may have been an effort to stabilize that wobbling and prevent this tipping effect to give mankind a little bit longer period to make this adjustment to the higher levels of consciousness. Because it's pretty obvious that we have the tendency not to learn from our own past. And maybe the wisdom that constructed these things was doing so to give us a little extra time to evolve.
Yes. It also, in respect to the pyramids, too, I want to make another distinction, and that is that in modern times, there have been several pyramids constructed in the United States. There's one in Memphis, Tennessee, that has served as a basketball arena, and occasionally a concert venue. And I have witnessed that firsthand, and in and I have photographs of that pyramid as well. And I noticed that the it's more of an equilateral triangle making up each of the four faces of the pyramid, as is the hotel in Las Vegas. However, the pyramids that we know are the ancient pyramids that were constructed, in particular the Shensi and the Giza pyramids, have different measurements. They're not equilateral triangles. The vertical sides of the pyramid are shorter than the base. The base is much longer, and it's that tipping lower, because an equilateral triangle stands up higher. If you make an equilateral triangle of any of the sides, well, of course, to make it fit like a pyramid, it would have to be symmetrical on all four sides. What happens is the measurement from the apex down to the base has to be phi. In other words, the proportion has to calculate to be the mathematical equivalent of phi in order for all of these metaphysical manifestations to occur. And that would have an impact on the vortex energy within the pyramid, as well as what can enter it and pass through it. And that does not occur to that extent or with that amplitude in an equilateral pyramid. So, in essence, those pyramids are just something to look at in Memphis and Las Vegas, and don't have the same metaphysical properties as the ones that we're talking about in Egypt and China and Central America and wherever else there happens to be one. It's a critical issue. And Patrick Flanagan himself, in that pyramid energy plate, which had very, very tiny pyramid shapes, they were still they were not equilateral, but they were according to the scale of the Egyptian pyramids.
Right.
That measurement is critical. So there's advanced mathematics, advanced physics, and advanced metaphysics involved in those structures would allow many, many anomalies that actually affect physical reality to take place. And this is anything that comes near or touches any of the points or the sides or is in the interior. The mummification of the pharaohs and their relatives that were buried there occurred more likely because of the power within the pyramid, not because of special herbs or salves or wrappings that were put on the bodies. That's pure nonsense. If that were the case, a casket could certainly preserve a body much better than a piece of cloth. and the animals that they find that have lost their way into the passages in the pyramid are picked up and thrown into a trash barrel outside, and they don't putrefy over time. They're in a mummified state, or a state of suspended animation. So there is a stabilizing effect that energy has on biological processes. And I would presume that could certainly stabilize the orbit of the Earth.
Well, we know that force is there. I mean, it's been measured by a number of people. I had a friend who was stationed in Cairo back in the mid-60s, and he was with the occupational UN forces. He's actually from Sweden. And he was kind of fascinated by the pyramids, and he hired one of those guys to take him to the Great Pyramid. And he climbed all the way to the top. The guide wouldn't go any further with him. And then when he did get to the very top, he was experiencing a wind, almost like an electrostatic wind, that was rising up and circulating around his body. And it was coming from all directions, almost as if it was blowing up the sides of the pyramid and then enveloping him as he stood at the top. And he described it as being a very forceful and noticeable effect that had absolutely nothing to do with desert breezes. And another interesting thing, which I mentioned to you earlier, was that during World War II, there was an article in Stars and Stripes magazine that warned pilots about flying over the Giza Pyramid Complex because it would have very drastic effects on the compasses in their planes and also some of the electronic equipment. So we know that there are forces present there which have absolutely nothing to do with our everyday understanding of reality as we practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, we've got to take a break. We actually went past our first hour here, but it was so interesting I didn't want to interrupt it. And we'll come back in a short moment. You're listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com, and we'll be back.
A monthly 24-page newspaper in its ninth year of addressing issues that affect all freedom-loving Americans, is one of the few remaining newspapers courageous enough to print the truth. Concerned about the burgeoning national debt and the Orwellian police state growing up around you? Subscribe today. Only $25 for 12 monthly issues, the Idaho Observer prints what you need to know to be a fully informed American. Go to idaho-observer.com or call 208-255-2307.
Hemp, the superfood for you and your family. Hemp has nutritional values that far exceed any known plant. Hemp, used for food, clothing, and shelter since time began. Hemp, this God-given food source is controlled by your government, making it not legal to grow for American people and farmers, but legal to import. Our founding fathers grew hemp because they knew of the benefits it offered. The protein are hemp U.S. will allow the body to heal itself from many ailments. Loaded with potassium, magnesium, calcium, essential fatty acids, amino acids, and nutrients not available in other plants. Hemp can be stored with a long shelf life as a life-sustaining food source for you and your family. Could this be the government's best-kept secret? Call today at 908-691-2608 and see what the powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Learn. Help. Shop at hempusa.org. We do not charge for shipping. That's 908-691-2608 or go to hempusa.org today.
Houston, we have a problem.
State your problem.
Picking up transmission from Mars.
We love PBS Radio. We love PBS Radio. We love PBS Radio. We love PBS Radio.
Welcome back to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our Friday night guest, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome back to the show. This is a fascinating discussion tonight.
Yes, it certainly is, and I didn't realize how late it was. I guess we really talked up a storm there for more than half our allotted time. With your permission, it might be interesting now to move into an explanation of where we feel all this is headed. And I would like to at least open the door to that and then hand it over to you, Don, because you know a great deal more about the metaphysical side of things than I do. But it's interesting to note that all of this activity, the utilization of this information gleaned from higher sources, accelerated evolution of mankind, and the race to get to a certain spiritual plateau before the next cycle of destruction on the planet is a theme which has been repeated many, many times on this Earth. Now, according to the Mayans, we are now in the fifth world, which means it's at least the fifth time since they were recording their history that we are undergoing this this race against time. And according to their calendar, something interesting is going to happen around 2012. I think it was on the 21st of December of that year. And I would just like to point out that in the past, total civilizations have disappeared from the Earth around the same time period. This has certainly happened to the Lemurians, to the Atlanteans. It has happened to, in more recent times, to the Mayans themselves, to the Chachapoyans in South America, and probably to other groups like the Olmecs and the Toltecs. And what's interesting about these disappearances is there are usually stragglers who stay behind and can talk about the glorious days of the civilizations to which they were connected, but for some reason they didn't go wherever the other ones went. And there have also been numerous periods of destruction and upheavals upon the Earth, which has also been recorded. Sometimes they were floods. Sometimes they were volcanic in nature. The last time seems to be a giant polar shift, which wreaked total havoc on the entire surface of the planet. And the people who stayed behind seem to have constructed fortresses and tunnels and places to hide to try and avert the catastrophe that was coming, which means that they knew about it, but they weren't sure how to protect themselves from it. And so they built these huge subterranean tunnels and underground vaults and cities and all sorts of things of that sort. Now, I find it very interesting, certainly in the form of a parallel, that the United States government is building underground bases, underground tunnel systems, subterranean cities, and all of that at our expense, and secretly preparing for something. And wouldn't it be interesting if they had occult information at their disposal suggesting that there's going to be the beginning of a new age on Earth, which could potentially be associated with violent upheavals, floods, you know, unbelievably strong winds, God only knows what else, but that they figure that they will survive by going underground. But the interesting thing is, as you pointed out, Don, the events which are coming may represent a sudden increase in overall consciousness accompanied by an accelerated vibratory rate, which would propel certain segments of the planetary population into a higher plane of existence, and thereby cause a separation between people of a certain spiritual level from people of a more primitive level, which might represent the warmongers, the thieves, politicians, and all of the rest of them that have been living like vampires off the rest of the population. And if that, in fact, is what is about to occur in the next few years, then it would be very interesting to elucidate on this mechanism and perhaps to project just what the meaning of this would be. And that's something that you know more about than me, Don, so I'd like you to comment on that if you don't mind.
Well, there have been several metaphysicians that have written about this, and I have my own thoughts and feelings about it, some based on actual experience of something that's transforming. We could look at the makeup of the human being as we know what science tells us, and in this case it would be the medical and the biological aspect of the scientific community telling us that we have two strands of DNA which are in a spiral. And the rest of the DNA we have is referred to in the science, in the genetic sciences, as junk DNA. Who in their right mind, with the capacity to create the miracle of the human being, would make such a foolish error to include junk DNA, a DNA that doesn't serve a purpose? It would be like a birthday cake that's got a shoe and a bar of soap in it, just because you felt like putting it in there. So, and I'm referring to an old episode of The Little Rascals when I described that. That just popped into my head. Seriously, what is occurring is that because of the influx of higher energies, which is coming in the form of light or photons, and it's being absorbed by every planet in the solar system, particularly in our Milky Way galaxy, this is a phenomenon that's occurring, which has the impact, since light carries information, and it's not of a destructive type, it has to result in an increase in vibratory rate on the planet itself, as well as within all the living things associated with the planet, which can only result in a higher consciousness. Now, there is a caveat that goes along with this light, and that if you are operating in the darkness, it may have some impact upon you, but it's probably going to activate your fear. If you're living in fear, if you're the creator of fear, as the Illuminati and their minions are, they are not in alignment. They're not able to sympathetically vibrate with this energy, nor are they able to increase their vibratory rate. It just won't affect them. In fact, it will have the adverse effect, because their intention is focused on creating an anti-universe, an anti-God, an anti-Christ, an anti-life. And everything is a reverse reality. Symbolic of that date, 1221, when I just ponder the date, December 21st of 2012, we have a 12 and we have a 21. Then we have a 2, and then we have another 12. So we have this mirror image of the 12. It adds up to a 3, and we have another 3. We have a 2, which could mean possibly to multiply, and then we have another 3. So We have a 9 and an 11. All of those numbers add up to 11. That's one of the magical numbers that the Illuminati use. And so one must discern, is this their creation? Well, the Mayans brought this out in their own calendar, and it's come out in various channelings and inspirational writings. Barbara Marciniak in her book, Bringers of the Dawn. Barbara Han Clow in several of her books has referred to this shifting of consciousness moving into a higher dimension. Since we are spiritual beings, we are inclined to move if we're going to change our frequency. We could be discarding or let's say abandoning the realm of the third dimension because it no longer serves its the purpose for us. Now, those that are operating in the dark, and this is a sort of prison planet in a sense, the fallen angels, according to the Bible, were cast down to the lower realms or the lower vibrations, and this would be one commensurate with our spiritual frequency and our spiritual abilities, our wisdom, and our accumulated experience. Standing in a vortex in Arizona, soon it's going to be 2 years ago, in another month it'll be 2 years ago, I had the experience of standing in two separate vortexes, and I could feel the energy swirling like you described this friend who was standing on the pyramid in Egypt and feeling this massive amount of wind or energy. It is a feeling like wind, only you don't hear the wind, but you feel the energy moving, just like you would feel the wind if you were standing outside and the wind was blowing. Now, when I stood in the outside vortex, which was on a lookout patio, and I faced a mountain, I had the impression, the distinct impression, that the mountain rose 3 feet. And I was seeing two mountains. I was seeing the mountain where it was before I stood in the vortex, and I was seeing another mountain 3 feet above, which to me was an indication that I was actually experiencing this shift that we're talking about. I was seeing the higher frequency just 3 feet above. So something as simple as a 3 foot displacement could create this whole reality in a flash. The earth could move into the fifth dimension in terms of consciousness. A new earth could be instantly created, and those that are in sympathetic vibration to that frequency, who have increased their frequency through the absorption of these photons that are going to repair or reconstruct our DNA. And there have been accounts of babies being born with three strands of DNA intact at the time of their birth. And it's my understanding that many of us have progressed several strands beyond the original two, and that our junk DNA is now realigning itself, much like you could take a handful of graphite and put it on a table and have it just be in a disordered, chaotic pile, and then take a magnet and pass it close enough to cause the particles of graphite to align to the magnetic pattern of the magnet without coming in close enough proximity to pull it up to the magnet, but just to put that force upon it. I think the same thing is happening to our DNA, and the same thing is happening to our consciousness. Now, since this is a higher vibration, it will not tolerate the lower frequencies. And so anything attached to the dark, anything attached to all of these negative aspects of our reality as it's created for us, or as we allow others to create it, will not even exist there. And we will be in a place where there is peace and love and harmony and joy and light. And then we will have immediate instant access to our higher gifts, our spiritual gifts, which have been repressed in this three-dimensional matrix that we're living in. So we will escape the matrix. Is that a rapture? Not in the biblical sense, and certainly not how organized Christianity is teaching that story, because to me that's all that is a story. They always have a savior or a messiah that's going to come, but first we must pay tribute to the middleman. And in this case, most of the time it's the preachers and the other religious figures that are the leaders of the organized religions around the world. This is something that the religions are not going to be able to escape. The fraudulent teachings, the dogmatic teachings, the lies that we've been told through those teachings, as well as through our education and the obfuscation of history and the attack upon the truth and universal law, will have consequences for those that perpetrate those acts. They could very well remain in the earth, in the three-dimensional world, and they can have their wars throughout the rest of eternity. And I'm sure many of us would be satisfied in seeing them get their just rewards. They may devolve to a lower frequency, as a karmic debt, so to speak, that they have to repay just for their own sakes, their own individual sakes, to again arise just to the level they're at right now. But hopefully, I don't wish any ill will towards their progress through evolution, but I don't see them moving to a higher state of consciousness. Quite the contrary, what they're doing is mimicking the higher vibrations, but they're doing it by doing the converse of what universal law does on its own.
Well, that's pretty deep stuff, and that this whole idea of a shift of consciousness and the movement of our planet into a higher vibratory state or another dimension brings a very interesting thought to mind. I have been conducting alternate energy research now for over 40 years, as you know, and mm-hmm. although I've made a lot of personal progress, and some of the associates that I have been in touch with over the years have also made a lot of progress in these fields, it seems as if the ultimate truth that we want to bring forth has always been prevented from happening. And maybe it's because, not just because there are impeding forces that don't want this in this particular manifestation, but maybe it's also because it's not meant to bless this particular dimension of expression. Maybe these researchers and this type of knowledge is meant to come forth after the transition that you're talking about, when there wouldn't be any opposition to it, but rather there would be a union to the greater good, and an overall harmony in step with the higher dimensionality that you're mentioning.
Yeah, cooperation.
yeah. Does that sound reasonable? I don't know.
Yes. Yes. Now, many ask the question, why don't we move to the fourth dimension? Why this jump? Well, the fourth dimension is known as the dimension of time, and it manifests itself in between the higher dimensions in a different way from where we are in this physical reality, and our dependence and the control our belief in time has upon us is not going to serve us. The spiritual dimensions are the odd numbered dimensions. The physical or the structured dimensions are in the duple numbers, or divisible by two. So we will transcend time. In fact, we will become instantly conscious of many things. Now, how rapidly that takes place is going to definitely have an impact on how soon we can begin creating in a more sensible way, because we're not using those faculties right now. We're using just a fraction of those abilities, and we're awakening to the potentiality of that experience. Until our DNA is rearranged, we won't be able to hold those frequencies as a physical being. It's quite possible that we will take on a completely different physical structure, and that the changing of the DNA in this dimension is a requirement to be able to move on to that next level. It's sort of like upgrading your software with all the software upgrades before you get the big upgrade, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I understand what you're suggesting, but let me ask a question. Do you have a feel for the time component, if that's the proper word to use, that it would take to make this phase shift? I mean, do you think it's going to be instantaneous, as you suggested, or do you think it's going to occur over a period of days, months, years? I don't know.
Well, I feel very strongly that since August of 1987, this has been occurring very naturally, and it's not something that has to go on forever. I think each individual has a choice on a soul level if they're going to participate in that. So those that are ready for it are going to be able to make that change in a blink of an eye. But this process has been going on for a number of years. That's the point I'm making. So it's not like this is something that's just going to change from today to tomorrow. This progression has already been underway. And, of course, the powers that be are well aware of it. It's been something that creates a lot of fear in their minds, which is why they try to cast that fear on us as a control mechanism. As long as they can keep us in a state of fear, they keep us from the awareness of what is occurring. Yet many people are waking up to this. Many people will account personally that they are experiencing many things. They're starting to understand things and know things and see things and hear things that were never part of their life's experience, regardless of how old they are. Even children are talking about these things. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the children are now being born with more of their DNA intact. That is a result of having parents with more of their DNA intact. And so we will progress very rapidly once the Earth is prepared and once enough of us are prepared. In the Creator's wisdom, infinite wisdom, this is being planned and has already occurred. We've just not experienced it yet, because it's really not in the future. It's in the eternal now.
Yeah, I understand. You know, Don, I had an experience quite a few years ago, and I didn't know what to make of it at the time, but I never forgot it because it was so intense. And it wasn't until my sojourn in Michigan and my exposure to Goetz and his strange philosophies that I began to really try to put this together. But I like to relate it to you and then cast it out as a question, subject to your interpretation. I had, I don't know what you call it, a dream or a vision or an out-of-body experience, but it was really very, very intense. And I've had, several of those in the course of my life. A lot of them had to do with the evolution of technological issues. But mm-hmm. Some of them were spiritual in nature, and others were just an absolute mystery to me at the time that they occurred. And that's the case with the one that I'd like to relate. Now, as you know, I originally hail from New Jersey, and I had the good fortune of growing up in Jersey City at a time when it was a really, really special place to be, for a number of reasons, which we have discussed in the past, and there's no point in going into it right now. But I'm very, very familiar with that whole area, and I'd explored it intimately as a kid. Well, this dream had to do with the area not far from the Lincoln Tunnel. And what's really strange about it is I can, even now as I begin to relate it to you, I can still see the images, I can still feel the sensations, and basically what I'm experiencing in this level of consciousness is very strange. There's this very, very large saucer-shaped vessel that's sitting on top of a sand dune, and various parts of the city of Hoboken and parts of Jersey City are covered with sand, and there's some kind of a change in the course of the Hudson River, and I'm climbing up this sand dune to get to this ship, which has it has like a gangway extended down, and I'm mm-hmm. and I'm hurrying up this slope. And there's all kinds of people chasing me. And I'm struggling to get to this ship, which is actually starting to energize. And I get the impression it's going to leave without me. Now, and that's all there is. I mean, there isn't any outcome to it that I can remember. But anyway, the experience is extremely intense and vivid. And it just always was festering in the back of my mind. Well, then, when I went to Michigan, tracking down the technologies that had emanated from Carr, and I met the late Mr. Goetz, mm-hmm. one of the things that he talked about was so striking that I was just blown away by it. And it made me wonder if the guy had an extremely acute imagination, or if he knew something that most people don't know. But basically what he said was this. He said that the spaceships that are truly under the control of the space brothers, or those who are working in the light, are interdimensional vehicles. And among other things, one of the responsibilities that these higher beings have is that they are responsible for ferrying the souls between planets, so that if a person expires on Earth and they were, let's say, evolved to the point where they need to go to another solar system or another planetary system to continue their overall evolution, it's impossible for them to go there on their own, because the envelope, the energy envelope around the Earth, vibrates at a particular frequency which imprisons the souls that are here, because they're meant to be here. But the ones that are ready to go somewhere else are actually ferried over by these craft after they have deceased, which I think is just an amazing story, even if he made it up. It's just an amazing tale. And he likened this entire transport concept to the guy that ferried the souls across the River Styx, which is reported in mythology. Now, those two things are fairly distinct from one another, even though they both involve the presence of a saucer. But the interesting thing is that I had a reading a number of years after that from a woman who was a pretty sensitive individual. And one of the things that she mentioned, and she did it so casually that I wasn't even impressed with it until I thought about it later on, and she said that various souls who are slated for departure from this realm, as she put it, have been given their evacuation instructions at birth. Now, this could be a product of my own imagination, but it just seems very interesting that all of these things that you're talking about coupled with some of the other things that we've mentioned on the show, seem to suggest that these mass migrations are going to occur. Do you think that it will be done in our corporal bodies, or do you think that this is something that's going to happen in a way that is, you know, totally foreign to us? Or do you think that the space people will be involved in this type of a transition, as was suggested by the dream that I had?
It could be a combination of things, and I say that not out of uncertainty so much as there could be someone that's not quite ready for the change as it takes place, and yet they're destined to make that change. You know, it's sort of like you have your ticket, you packed your bag, and the taxi's late getting you to the airport on time. It may not totally be in your control, but I think to more specifically answer your question, you'd have to ask yourself why our DNA is being reassembled or reconstructed in its original state. And that would be, of course, that we could better manifest our true nature. And it's, on a spiritual sense, we are all creatures of light, and that this experience here in a physical body does not negate that fact, and that we are eventually going to be more in touch with that. So we could become something of a different physical nature. We could manifest ourselves instantaneously in another form, or in the same form, or a heightened state of the same form is what I'm saying, or maybe just assume a light body of sorts. Now, I would say that we would have some physicality. There are beings that are higher evolved than us that can move from one dimension or another, and they're going to appear in that reality as us. If they were to come down here, of course, we see the physical bodies. Reptilians are masters at DNA manipulation and mimic our DNA. It doesn't mean necessarily that they're of a higher vibration. It's just that they understand the principle that's required to be able to do that. In our case, since we're moving to light, we're moving to a more positive and higher vibration, and we're not going to be subjected to these negative forces, we are going to realize more who we are. Our consciousness is going to be heightened, and as a result, what we're able to manifest creatively is going to be much broader, much more significant. So I would assume that we are going to have a physical manifestation, but we are going to also have a greater understanding of our light body and our true essence. Whether that's going to appear to us or not is another story. But I can tell you in the third dimensional world we're in, I can see the manifestations of one's light body in the auras, in the etheric body, the crown chakra, and often even other manifestations. So I think it's just going to be heightened. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does in a way. I find that really interesting about the third strand of DNA, because, you know, in my work with electricity over the years, the difference between single phase and three phase is pretty pronounced. And from what I remember of the structure of standard DNA, you know, you have the interlocking spirals. If you view them from the side, they look like two sine waves that are 180 degrees out of phase, and they're joined together by the little the connecting molecules. Mm-hmm. But it would be fascinating if you worked a third strand in there, and then they were all shifted slightly in phase. You know, now you have you have three sine waves in three space, which is which are separated by 120 degrees instead of 180 degrees, and the amount of interconnecting possibilities would increase enormously by making that variation.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to know from if you happen to know the answer, I would love to know how they have found out about these babies being born with a third strand of DNA and what they have to say about it, because it's such a mind-blowing thing to imagine that type of construction that I can't believe that somebody would just shrug it off as an uncomfortable anomaly.
Well, if you consider that we are 12 stranded beings, having 10 of the strands disabled, and these infants are able to enter this reality, this third dimensional world, and manifest awesome psychic abilities. For instance, they can look at an empty glass and fill it with water through the thought. What does that say about the potential when you're looking at the fact that that's three strands of DNA is one-fourth the capacity of what we are on a physical level, and what that would enable us to tie into in terms of the rest of the universe? So,
well, I mean, it opens up unbelievable possibilities. I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind, actually, is the story of the Forbidden Planet, where the Krell were actually manifesting things that they desired through the act of pure creation. I mean, that's basically what you're talking about. If I want a drink of water and all I got to do is look at a glass and express my desire and it fills with water for me, that's a pretty intense development. And something that's capable of happening with only one quarter of the available DNA strands, then you're almost going to be talking about a semi-divine being if you connect them all up.
Well, yeah, that's what metaphysics speaks about, our true nature. We're created like God with those same gifts. Now, does that mean we can create the universe or planetary systems? I'm not implying that whatsoever, but at least on a human being level, we are going to go more towards our true nature. This is what's being challenged here. This is the reason for all the chaos and the insatiable greed and the insatiable quest for power over others, is that those who tried to be God were cast down through their own, it was their own making, their own design. And so now they're trying to sell that to us. It's as though, it's like what my Wednesday night guest this week, actually it was last week already, Joe Church had mentioned. What has come to him through his experiences, and he is both a biblical scholar and an abductee with an implant. He asserts that we are here. This is the final opportunity for us to choose between Satan and God, to choose between the dark and the light. And that's obviously a foreboding of something that's going to change besides our basic nature. In other words, mankind has been given this opportunity a number of times, as you pointed out, and we have made certain choices, and I'm not conscious of exactly what choices I made. However, I know what choice I have made now, what choice I am making. This is a choice in action, and so I know where I'm going to be. I have no doubts about that. And I think, to more specifically finish answering your question, I suppose the same methodology that can be used to determine what a two-stranded DNA construct looks like in a human being will produce evidence that there's a third strand activated. We're talking about a newborn baby. Wouldn't it be interesting if we could all be examined with integrity to determine how where we are in that process? Very likely some of us are in the fifth or sixth or seventh strand of our DNA having been reconstructed. Certainly those that are more loving and more caring and compassionate and creative and sensitive are exhibiting something beyond the norm. How would you account?
I have to go along with that because the norm, as you call it, is frighteningly disappointing at this point. And I hate to say it, but just in a few years I've been on this planet, I have actually witnessed a diminution of the average, not an increase in the average, and it's been very disappointing to me. I can still remember having conversations with my father where he asked me why my behavior was so obtuse as a boy. And I told him, I said, I'm terribly disappointed with my own species. And that was back in the 50s when it was hardly noticeable compared to today. So while we definitely may have people here and there, that are aspiring to wonderful heights, there's an awful lot of people that are going the other way, and it's very, very disturbing.
Yes. Well, Jim, it's a matter of choice, number one. We can wish that for others. Those of us that have been enlightened about anything always seek to share that with others in the hope that they will seek that out themselves. Because no one really chooses to be alone. In fact, if we are all one, all we are trying to do is remember ourselves in our oneness. The humanity in that sense is a being, a single being in and of itself, made up of a bunch of individual or individualized parts, each being a whole unto itself. And yet we exist in that, and we're striving to experience all the pleasures of our individuality while we ignore our oneness with each other. That is the reality that we're going to move to, where we experience that and the cooperation and all the positive benefits of that. Now, and it goes beyond feeling. Most people, even if you show this to someone, if you can wake them up enough to cause them to understand what this is, most people will still turn it down because they have been accustomed to having others do their bidding for them, make their decisions for them, tell them what to do, complain about it if they don't like it, but what do they do in the end? They go ahead and do it anyway. Even while they're acknowledging that something is wrong, they wait for someone else to fix it. And that's the apathy and the laziness that goes along with the rest of the dumbing down.
Yeah, so, I have to agree with you there. There's no doubt about that. And I don't believe there's going to be any savior that's going to produce a mass change in the dilemma of humanity. That's a lot of nonsense. We are created in such a way that in order for us to progress in a meaningful way, we have to exert effort and take responsibility for our own evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are all our own saviors, so to speak. And the choice of exerting ourselves and climbing the ladder towards a higher spiritual realm or just being couch potatoes in the third dimension is ours entirely. Nobody's going to come along and help you one way or the other. I really believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I posed a question on last night's show to Michael Herzog. And it was sort of a political nature because it really points out how insane our thinking is and how much we rely on someone else to do what we are quite capable of doing on our own. This whole concept of a Messiah that's going to come here and save us. It has to save us from ourselves, number one. And I use the example of the presidents of the United States. If you were to look at 1 through 43 and ask which one of those presidents exhibited any qualities or characteristics of a Messiah, of a Savior, which one would it be? And the answer was none. So why have we progressed to a stage or a point in our consciousness now where we have an individual that can't even prove he's an American who is being lauded as the best thing since sliced bread and being called the Messiah? He's not even the president, and he's being called the Messiah. On what basis?
Well, I think it's because, I'm sorry, go ahead. I think it's because his policies and the things that he's advocating are in resonance with the overall attitude, which is to have government do everything for the majority of the people. And so they perceive him as the answer to their prayers. Where in reality, the whole thing is fraudulent because there's no way that a society can prosper or even continue if everybody gets on that bandwagon. I mean, now you have about half the middle class supporting everybody else. Well, what happens when they get disgusted of carrying that burden? And let's say all of us go on Social Security, all of us go on welfare, all of us have our hand out to the government. The heck with producing anything, the heck with striving for something better. So how does that continue then? Where do we go from there?
Well, I asked the rhetorical question, how do we jump from being dumbed down sheeple to being so enlightened and so discerning? Over the activity of somebody pulling a lever or pushing a button on November 4th. How did that occur? Obviously, I'm being a bit facetious, you know, but...
Yeah, well, it didn't occur. That's the answer.
Yeah, we're as a society, we're collectively ignorant of our own stupidity in our own somnambulistic state. So this is what's not going to make it through this shift that we've been talking about, this change that we've been describing. And we have a technocracy. We have a society that's dependent upon technology for bringing us pleasure, for telling us when, what, and how to do whatever it is we do. And there's nothing being propelled or launched via the flame or the spark that comes from the spirit. Now, that's not everyone, but the majority, the masses, are in that state. Despite the fact that these changes are taking place, which is why those that are in power are so fearful of us waking up. Because enough of us wake up, that balance will shift, just like the pyramids. We don't have pyramids sitting next to each other all the way around the world. They're spread out. Just like the people who are waking up, they're spread out. Sort of assisting the earth in this process, and likewise the earth will assist us. And woe be to the ones that are behind, left behind. I wish them well.
Yeah, it's going to be a real interesting place not to be.
Well, Jim, we're out of time. It's been very enlightening for me and interesting, inspirational. I hope it's been that way for you and for the listening audience.
Yes, indeed. You know, I enjoy talking about this stuff all the time. I mean, you and I talk like this even off the air. So naturally, when we do it more formally and there's a greater exchange involved, I think we all benefit from it. I know I do.
Yeah, the only thing is when we're talking off the air, we have a much smaller listening audience, don't we?
Yeah, but we also have much more energetic conversations sometimes because of that.
Yeah, much more descriptive, I think. Well,
yeah.
It's been fun, and we're at that point where I have to say goodnight to you and the listening audience. So I look forward to next week's show, as usual. And I wish you a great weekend and a good week. And let's see where we go in another 7 days.
Yes, sir. It should be interesting. And God willing, I'll be back to talk to you about something else. And I'm sure we'll produce another interesting show for our listeners.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say goodnight to our listening audience. You have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Jim Murray. Special thanks go out to Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And Don was running the sound tonight, so let's give him a round of applause.
Yay!
And with that, also I'd like to thank the listening audience for tuning in. And I wish you all a great weekend, and above all, a peace-filled, love-filled, light-filled night, and a good night.